It's time for Mac Geek Gab, and listener Perry brings us our quick tip of the week with, you probably knew that when you play an audio stream on your iPhone, you can set a timer to act as a sleep timer with the alarm to stop playing instead of a sound. So, did you know that the reverse is also true? If you pause your audio stream in Sirius, Apple Music, etc., and then set the timer time and set the alarm to stop playing, it will actually start playing that stream when the timer ends. I don't know how long a timer you can set, but it worked with a 5-minute timer, and I had no idea of this odd functionality, but there you are. Perhaps it'll be useful to someone. More tips like this, plus your questions answered today on Mac Geek Gab number 1083 for Monday, March 31st, 2025.
Welcome to Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in tips just like that. We share them. You send in cool stuff out. We share that stuff too. You send in your questions. We share them. And bonus, sometimes, hopefully most of the time, we even answer them, or at least talk through how that answer might be found. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, on World Backup Day, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in South Dakota, I'm Adam Christensen.
And here also in New Hampshire, it's Pilot Pete. Good to be back this week.
Yeah.
I made it in spite of my best efforts.
We missed you, man.
So I did it? Yeah. So, hey, quick addendum on that opening quick tip. The alarm thing and timer, I also found out that, hey, rather than set an alarm, you can say, hey, S-Lady, set a timer to go off at 7 a.m. tomorrow. And she does all the math.
Oh.
So, yeah. So you could use that as an alarm if you want to wake up to a given music or something like that. Set the stop playing and you go, hey, S-Lady, set a timer to go off at 7 a.m.
Oh,
and if it's,
I like
you know,
that.
Yeah. If it's 8 hours, 43 minutes and 12 seconds, it starts.
So you're just you're
so
describing
instead of setting
it,
an alarm for,
instead of saying set an alarm, you're saying set a timer, and the difference of words will decide whether it's just setting an alarm. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. Very cool. I like it.
Yeah. We got probably some show business and then some tips, Dave.
Yeah.
What do you think?
It's World War Day. It's World Backup Day. It's also Police Code 1083. It is work or school crossing detail is what it seems you found, right, Adam?
Yeah, I didn't know what a work crossing was. I've never heard of that. School crossing.
I think it's probably road work or something.
Like road work. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. If you have a big factory with a parking lot across the street from the factory, maybe they have a crossing guard for that too. I don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Good opportunity for some overtime, but looks like a miserable detail in the big scheme of things. Because it's not always nice in springtime out.
Well, that's the difference, isn't it? Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. It's World Backup Day, so
yes.
I figure it's worth at least...
Hold on, back up. It's what day? Sorry.
Thanks.
That's what I do, Dave.
So great that you're back. Can we back up to last week, Adam? No, just kidding.
Yeah. Adam tried. He was 10 minutes ahead of us behind us
true.
Or something.
Yeah. I figure it's as good a time as any to talk through our backup routines, at least at a top level. And, you know, like often happens on this show, we'll have a conversation about something for some reason, and that will catalyze kind of a recurring discussion for a few weeks about that topic as we kind of dissect it and hone down on it. So this is as good a time as any to kick off that discussion. Pete, you want to go first? Adam, you go first.
Here's where so anybody who had listened to my show for a long time or knows me, backups are hugely important to me. And I generally had for the longest time a very, robust backup solution. So always Time Machine. There would always be a Time Machine backup running. I happen to have mine set up locally for my wife and my kids. It was a network Time Machine backup. And then also cloud backup. So using Backblaze, I have that running. And then I would have what I called my kind of archival backup, or more specific backup, where I would use ChronoSync to back up very specific folders and documents and things in very specific ways to a Drobo that I had connected.
Okay.
So that example of that would be like, for when I was doing MacCast, it would always take my, anything that was in my MacCast folder, which was all of my source files, all of my show notes, all of my materials, and it would one way sync that, back that up to the Drobo. And then that Drobo folder was also backed up to Backblaze.
Oh, wow. Because Backblaze will let you
back up local external connected drives. So like that specific folder. And like I said, it was a one way. So I could always delete anything in that folder on my Mac and know that there was a copy on the Drobo. And then there was a copy of that in the cloud. Like it never went away. And so I do that with a lot of folders. I was also a web developer. So all of my like web projects and code and all that stuff was the same kind of thing. My photos was similar kind of thing. So there were specific strategic things that it was like, all right, this is the stuff I want to have, make sure I have a third copy of, that it's an archive, that what's in there will never go away, even if I delete it on my local Mac. And that was kind of my setup for years. What I have to admit is, since kind of quasi-retiring from podcasting and doing a lot of my outside development work, because I kind of ran my own business for a while, and then that turned into, when I went back to work full-time for somebody, that turned into little side projects, but it kind of got less and less and less, and I'm pretty much not doing any of that anymore. So I very rarely have my Mac connected, and a lot of the backup solution was reliant, especially the Time Machine, on external USB-C drives.
Right.
Well, I was having issues with those disconnecting, and it was causing other problems during things like shows like this. So one day I just got pissed, and then turns out this was just a little over a year ago. Uh-oh. And I just disconnected all that stuff. I was like,
so you haven't had a deal with it. You haven't Time Machine backed up out of a bout of frustration. You have not Time Machine backed up in over a year
since March 17th, 2024. Apparently, I was just checking.
Huh.
Yeah, and Time Machine likes to pop up and remind me, hey, you haven't Time Machine backed up in, you know. But actually, it's good we're having this conversation, because I just realized, why haven't I set this up like I have my wife and kids set up? Because I have the Synology. It has a Time Machine network backup thing. Like,
right.
I just need to move to that.
You just need to do it.
So yes. I'm going to do that this week.
Like, Your Time Machine backups are less up to date than mine are on this machine here in the studio. However, this machine in the studio has not backed up to Time Machine since November 22nd of 2024.
Yeah.
And yeah, because so it fails,
In my defense, I do want to say I still have the Backblaze backup running. So there is a backup. But I really only have one backup. But I don't do a lot on this machine anymore. Like, honestly, like, I'm not recording this show. Like, I'm not putting stuff onto it that
sure.
I need to protect anymore. And all of the stuff that I wanted protected, again, is in those other locations. It's already on the Time Machine backup. It's already in the thing. I'm not creating any real new content on that machine. And also, I will point out, anything in my documents folder is also in iCloud. So that's in iCloud. That's in Backblaze. So I at least have two copies of the stuff that I really care about.
Yep.
And, but I do need to get back to a Time Machine backup for sure. And I was like, I don't know why it didn't dawn on me. It's like, just set it up as a network one, and then it'll just do its thing when it's just sitting around the house plugged into power, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Easy peasy. Problem solved.
Problem solved. There you go. Yes, exactly. How about you, Pete? What do you,
yeah,
what's your backup routine look like?
man, computers are reliable. They never break. Hard drives, you know, what do you need to back up for? You know, no.
Okay. Yeah, especially one from 2019, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, it's going to be fine. Yeah, you're totally fine. Listen, if it's worked this long, Adam, it's just going to keep working forever. I'm sure.
Absolutely. So I actually, I use the Time Machine. That thing constantly runs to my Synology drive. And now I have two Synologies. One backs up to the other, so that's kind of cool. I really like that. But the main thing, my main source, if I were to lose my laptop, so to speak, I would go to that Time Machine backup. But the other thing is, and I just realized that sitting here on the desk, I looked, oh, it's not there. I have one of these little Seagate USB hard drives. It's like 2 terabytes.
Okay.
And I should, after the show, plug it back into Debbie's iMac and get that up and running so that it's constantly running a backup to that. And so I try to do that to all the machines in the house. I have both CCC backup and Super Duper, and I run those probably every 6 weeks or so. I'll run a complete clone of my laptop.
Yep.
And then the other thing is, what's it called? It's just Synology Drive, right? It's like your own personal Dropbox.
Yep.
So all of our household, Debbie needs an insurance policy or some other document or receipt or things like that. We have a mutual folder that everything kind of goes into. And so if one computer is lost or broken or something like that, it's still there. Now, that being said, it's just as easy for something to go in and corrupt that and delete it.
Sure.
So my hope is that the Synology backing up to the other Synology would preserve that in the event we needed it. That's
okay.
But that's kind of the extent of it. There's not a whole lot there. There's some, you know, a synchronization is not a backup. A cloud is not a backup. But it's better than nothing.
Well, I would disagree with that. With an asterisk. I would add an asterisk to that. A sync without versioning is not a great backup, is how I would describe that. But a sync with versioning, man, that's backup. In my world, like I've been able to go and get that stuff out of a backup. So, yeah, sync with versioning, which is what Synology Drive will do. iCloud Drive, no. Synology Drive, yes, assuming you turn it on, which you can. So, yeah, and my setup, I use a lot of the same things you guys do. I attempt to have Time Machine on every one of my Macs running to some local network destination. Whether it decides to start failing like this machine did in November and I didn't catch it yet, fine. But it's not, Time Machine is not my primary, it's not the primary thing that I rely on as a backup. However, if I need to restore something from a backup, it is often the first place that I will go, assuming it's been working, just because it's so easy. I use CCC backup on every one of my Macs to copy some files to my NAS every day, and then also clone the entire drive to another local drive that's sitting right there on every one of my desktop Macs anyway. The other thing that I make a lot of use of is Hazel from Noodlesoft, which is kind of like folder actions the way they should have been done. If kids, you can ask your parents what folder actions are supposed to be. But what Hazel does is you point it at a folder, and you can point it at many folders and give it a set of rules. And it can do things with these rules. It can delete old files and nothing else. It can, like, I have mine set to, like, with all the audio that I capture for the podcast, it goes into a local folder on my Mac. Anything that's more than 2 weeks old via a Hazel rule is first copied to my a folder on my Synology and then erased from my local drive. So that I used to get into a scenario. It was like, how did I run out of space on this computer? Oh, I've got a year's worth of podcast recordings. That's why, you know. So Hazel just deals with that for me and puts it off over there. I also, on one of my Macs, use Arc ARQ backup to do some local backups. It can back up to destinations like Amazon S3 and things like that. I have it backing up to an S3 destination that's actually my disk station. But again, it's just more sort of belt and suspenders kind of stuff. But you could certainly use it to back up to a cloud destination that like an S3 or anything like that. And then speaking of Amazon S3, I back up my Synology, most of the data on it, basically excluding media, like video files, movies specifically, because I can't afford the cloud storage that it would take to be able to hold all my movies. But I use Synology's Hyper Backup to back up everything, including all the stuff that I dump to it, like the podcast downloads or the podcast recordings and all that stuff, is backed up to a cloud destination that is at iDrive E2. And this is S3 compatible storage. I've mentioned S3 a few times. S3 is Amazon's cloud storage offering, and it is all done. You interface with it via, I mean, there are web interfaces that you can use, but your backup software uses API calls, and those API calls are published and well known, and I guess not copyrighted or anything, so other people can create apps, their own apps with their own storage that are compatible with those S3 calls. So iDrive E2 is an S3 compatible backup destination. And it's cheap, like inexpensive. I don't want to say it's cheap because I've had very good luck with it, but it is inexpensive. You know, your first year of 1 terabyte is $24.75. That's a full year. That's half price. Your second year, and they know they've got you, so I understand this. Your second year is $50, but it's $50 for a terabyte of storage in the cloud for an entire year. And obviously, you can scale up from there. So I'm a big fan of iDrive E2, and your first year is half price, so you can go check it out. We'll put a link in the show notes to that. But that's what I back my Synology up to, is the iDrive E2 destination. And it's relatively inexpensive, and I think I have 2 terabytes, so I'm paying $100 a year. And then my Synology can just blast to that with Hyper Backup. My movies are backed up, but only locally. I just back them up to another disk station. And it's getting to the point where I don't even know that I can afford the hard drives for the storage to keep as that keeps growing. But that's a Dave issue. So, yeah.
It's a Dave problem.
Oh. If only Apple would compete with those prices.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you imagine? Or if only Apple would let me choose my photo sync storage location. Yeah. I know why they don't. As an Apple shareholder, I'm well aware of why they don't. But there is one other thing. I have a monthly reminder recurring on my calendar that says check backups. I do whatever computer I am on. When I see that notification, I check all of its backups. Now, obviously, it's imperfect. I haven't addressed. I've been aware of the issue with Time Machine on this computer for a while, but I'm at least reminding myself once a month, hey, think about backups. And, you know, I'll check Lisa's computer once a quarter kind of thing. Just something to keep my head in the game so that I'm aware of the holes in my backup strategy, I think.
Yep. Yeah. So am I. I think going back to my earlier thing, I think that is a big part of this, right? If you know you're not doing backups properly and you're willing to like say, okay, I'm not, that's okay too, but you're doing it with full eyes open. But don't be naive and think, kind of like we were joking about, but a lot of people do think like, oh, it's a solid state drive in my computer. What could happen? It's never going to go bad. I'm totally safe. And that's the trap. That's where you get caught.
Yes.
That's when that enters your brain. That's when you get caught. Now, me knowing my Time Machine's broken for so long, I know I'm going to get caught if I don't do something about it.
Yes.
And I'm willingly have chosen for a year that I didn't care enough about it to do it.
You can, well, you can suffer you are aware of what the consequence is, and right. You've decided that you can suffer that risk
Correct.
If it were to happen, that's all. Like you said, eyes wide open.
Yeah. If my tribe died and I lost what's ever on there right now, it'd be like, yeah, that's your fault.
Yeah.
It's gone. You get to live with that choice.
Yeah, that is a choice that you made in the past, and now you're living with it. Dan Kuehling, and I hope I'm pronouncing your last name right, Dan, said in our YouTube chat, actually, that he says, my best way to describe Hazel is email rules for your file system. I love that. Thank you, Dan.
That was great.
That's a great description.
I hadn't even thought about using Hazel in that sense, because I use it like if I download my American Express statement, it goes into my downloads folder. Hazel immediately reads it, grabs it, renames it, dates it, and throws it in my American Express statements folder. It's like, but I never thought about using it, like, because I'm constantly manually pulling old shows off, putting them down on the Synology drive, and cleaning off my. It's like, brilliant.
So, yeah. No, Hazel's great. Yeah, I can't imagine. That's another one of those apps that, like, it just does its thing. I don't know when the last time was I built a new Hazel rule, but it's probably once in the last year. But I have probably 15 Hazel rules running constantly, and if I didn't, my drives would just fill up, and I wouldn't know where anything was. It just it's super reliable and super efficient. It just the only time, and it's really not an issue. The only time that I am even sort of made aware of Hazel is when I get an error from it saying, hey, your network drive's not mounted, so I can't move the thing that you want me to move. And it doesn't delete it. Like, it knows I have the rule set up to stop. Yeah. And I know that, I don't even need to worry about it, because at some point in the next few days, I'm going to reboot and my network drive's going to remount the right way. And then Hazel will just take care of it. And it's all totally fine.
Yeah, there you go. And he says it's Kuehling.
Kuehling. Thank you, Dan. Yeah, good stuff.
So just a couple last things to add. I don't know, because we're probably getting close to moving on. I want to mention that before I ripped all my drives out, I also did have a CCC backup running. So that's another part of the backup thing. I think that's common among all of us.
It is.
And then you said something very interesting about Time Machine. Like, you said, that's the first place you'd go to try and, like,
restore,
grab something, even though, you know, like, yeah, it's a very easy place to restore. I also have often said, and I still believe this to this day, if you are not doing backup currently, I think Time Machine is the perfect place to start, because it's super easy. Get a USB powered little drive, like Pete showed earlier. I have ones from Western Digital or Seagate or whoever. And it can even be a spinning drive if you want to save money and get more storage. But, you know, SSDs have come down more, so they'll be more performant and faster. And, like, there's advantages, and we've talked about those in the past. But get some sort of external bus-powered USB-C drive. Plug it in. When it asks you, do you want to use this as a Time Machine backup, say yes. And my general rule in terms of Time Machine, for just the history of it, is get one that's about two times the size of whatever your internal drive is. And just let it back up your internal drive. Yeah. It's super easy. And turn it on. Now you have at least one form of backup.
Yep. As long as Time Machine remains reliable.
Yeah.
I mean,
mine, I just noticed, has a dent in it.
Oh, wow.
Still running. It's a spindle drive. Still running with a dent in it. Gotta love it.
Hopefully not a dent in the platters. But
right.
Yeah. I mean, Time Machine's been reliable for me for 10 years now. I don't know how long we've had it for. I started using it when it first came out. And I mean, back in the early days, it wasn't as reliable, but I think nowadays
they would corrupt. Have they changed the method Dave? Have they changed method by which Time Machine works?
Still uses hard links, but the file system has been updated.
Yes.
With the idea that Time Machine is going to be used. Time Machine was a bolt on to HFS Plus. And and hard links were a bolt on to HFS Plus. They were literally stored in a text file. Like, I talked about, I did like a backups session at Macworld once. And after the session, somebody came up to me who, it turns out, was an Apple engineer, but, like, did not want that you know, made public at all. And they're like, listen, there's something you need to know about HFS Plus and Time Machine. I was like, oh my gosh, holy crap. Like, I wish I knew that before my presentation. They're like, well, I mean, yeah, but you can't say that in your presentation. Like, oh no, I could say it. I just am not going to attribute it to anyone. And people are going to ask me, how do you know this? And I'm just going to say, I know things. I'm Dave and I know things. Yeah.
That's what I do.
That's what I do. That's it. Yeah. And he was like, oh yeah, that's okay. Yeah. He's like, just don't say where it came from. So I don't even remember who this person was. Like, I don't believe there's someone that I'm still in touch with. If they are, I have completely forgotten that it was you that gave me that information. It was in my memory is that this was a random person that came up and I had one interaction with them, which was great. So, that's
so you how it also forget things. You're Dave, you know things and you forget
and
things.
I forget the right things, Pete.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, I don't. I forget the wrong things, but all the time. I think we should go to Quick Tips.
Yeah.
I remember that. That's where we were.
Yeah. Karsten had an interesting quick tip for us about AirTags. Karsten is someone who travels quite a bit and winds up using different pieces of luggage depending on, you know, how long of a trip he's taking and that sort of thing. And his advice is twofold. Number one, unless you just want to spend a bunch of money on AirTags and put AirTags in every suitcase you own, which for some of us is totally fine, some of us not so fine, and it really depends on the number of suitcases you have. I suppose disposable income is part of this, but, you know, Karsten's advice is take your AirTags and a label maker and number them. So you've got AirTag 1, AirTag 2, AirTag 3, AirTag 4. That way, when you are looking at the AirTag, you know exactly which one it is and you don't have to like hold it up to a phone to identify it and do all that stuff. Then in your phone, name the AirTags, you know, 1, Dave's red away suitcase, you know, 2, Dave's large purple suitcase, whatever, 3, Dave's backpack, you know, whatever it's going to be. And you can change those names in the Find My app. And of course, they'll change kind of throughout the system if you're syncing with other people or whatever. But that way, it's easy to move things around and you know, all right, AirTag 2 is in that, AirTag 3 is here, AirTag 1 is here. And it just makes it simpler to kind of bounce things around easily. So, yeah, I like that tip. Thanks, Karsten. Good stuff.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, Adam.
Something quick to add to that.
Yeah.
If you are ordering AirTags from Apple, you can have them engraved for free. And not only that, they have numbers all the way 1 through 50. So you could just engrave the number.
That's even
them.
Better. Oh, yeah. I like that. Yeah, that's really smart. Love it. Oh, man. I love when quick tips have bonus quick tips. Yeah, good. Bill has our next quick tip, and we've been talking enough. Bill, take it away.
Hey, guys. Bill from Menlo Park here. Here's a quick tip. If you're viewing a page in Safari and it's not coming up right, like you run a search and nothing shows up, but you know it's there, it's probably the content blockers that Safari has. And I used to do this and curse and then copy the URL and paste it into Chrome or Edge or Firefox. But now I've noticed today that under the View menu, in the bottom half, where it has Stop and Reload page, it has an option that says Reload without content blockers. Suddenly, the website I was looking at works. So that's it. Reload without content blockers. It's a menu option under View in Safari on the Mac. Bye.
Amazing.
How cool is that?
I use an ad blocker some of the time. And when it's AdBlock Plus or something, I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. I'll figure it out. I think it's AdBlock Plus. Anyway. There is an option in the Safari toolbar where I can click and say, allow ads on this page, right? And that will work in about 6 hours. But if I want it to allow ads on this page now, The only way I can do it is either, you know, copy the URL and move to Chrome where I don't have an ad blocker installed, or, you know, go in and turn off the entire extension system wide. But the, for whatever reason, the UX of allow ads on this page or this site does not work immediately. I had never realized until Bill's tip came in that I could just go to view, reload without content blockers and everything.
I think that's new.
Maybe
I could be wrong.
I've used it for forever.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Like years.
It it's been hidden in plain sight right there.
It has.
Sorry, I use one blocker is the ad blocker I use. Yeah.
Same one I use.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. But it does, I can't get it. Like if I tell it allow on this page or this site, it is not an immediate thing for me. I don't know why, but anyway.
Yeah, having to go in and hit the settings and mess with all that, which is what I want. Man.
Yeah.
Love That's it. A great setting. I'm glad he pointed it out. You know, it's hidden in plain sight this whole time.
I believe you, Adam, obviously, that it's been there forever. But Bill is the one who made me aware of it.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. I don't remember if it's always been accessed the same way. But I remember right clicking on the URL bar, I think, and you can get it as an option.
Yeah.
How do they expect us to see it when it's right there in the menu? Come on.
Right-clicking on the URL bar.
I think it used to. Maybe that's how I used to use it.
Yeah, I'm not seeing it that way.
Yeah, so they changed it.
Yeah.
So now I think they have the little icon or whatever it is.
Yeah, right. Can I? Oh, no. If you right-click on the reload the little arrow in a circle. If you right click on that, you can choose reload there without content blockers. Nice catch.
I always accessed it from.
Huh. I wonder if you click on that with the option key held down, what happens? It's like Clark's on the streams.
Nothing. Nothing. Well, the same thing that happens in the view menu. It does not change the reload without content blockers option, but it does the reload page if you hold down the option key in either place, the view menu or the right click from the circle in an arrow thing, changes from reload page to reload page from origin. Can you articulate, Adam, and I know I'm putting you on the spot, what the difference between reload page and reload page from origin is?
I am just seeing this for the first time, but my guess would be, this is something to do with
click through
one of the security features that Apple has added recently, right? Where if you're using the don't they route stuff through some of their servers for
For iCloud Private Relay?
Yeah, or one of those services.
No, I don't think it's that. I think it predates that. But I could be wrong. My use case of this, let me put it that way, is to force Safari to reload all of the cached things like JavaScript and CSS from origin, even if the local cache hasn't expired.
That was my first guess. Yeah. So,
yeah,
that makes
that's
sense.
That's the general consensus online. I'm looking at a Stack Overflow discussion about it, that it will bypass the cache. Yeah. So, but maybe also what you're saying, it's possible both are true.
The developer documentation for the reload from origin function, if you're using a WebKit view, says reloads the current web page and performs end-to-end revalidation of the content using cache validating conditionals, if possible. So, yeah.
Okay.
Confirms you're not getting any cached stuff, basically. Yeah,
okay. That makes sense. Yep.
Nice.
All right. You want to take us to Karsten's second tip of the day, Pete?
I will. And this one's cool. I really like this. I'm going to start doing this. He says, in an episode, you spoke about password managers and a concern about if a company gets breached. Here's my super easy tip to never get caught. I use 1Password, not that that matters, but for any website that falls into the category of financial content, banks, or anything with personally identifiable information, health related, et cetera, et cetera. He says, I save the password as I normally would. However, on the website, I manually add 6 characters that only I know. Then, when I save the name of the website, I add an asterisk symbol to the end of the name and disable the 1Password autofill for that website. When I now select a website in 1Password containing an asterisk, the password will autofill and I only need to complete the last 6 characters to log in. If 1Password gets breached, the hackers still don't have the right password because you can't hack what's not there. Brilliant.
I like this.
That is awesome.
I have things to add. Adam, were you about to say something or no?
No. I'm just thinking through this. So it's like just basically adding a pin after the password, right? You have a known pin that you use, but only you know it. Yeah, interesting.
So an issue with this is if your actual password, like the password and the PIN all inclusive, gets divulged somewhere, and maybe 2 passwords get divulged somewhere, that PIN now is seen as being common to 2 of them. Someone might be able to deduce. I mean, they need to really be targeting you, right? So I think Karsten's plan here is a solid one for the most part. The thing I have always done, or not always, but I started doing maybe 10 years ago, for those things that I just absolutely don't want to store in a password manager, at least not in a way that someone else could use them, is I will use references to things that I know. So everything is different. So, for example, and I'm trying to think of an example here that's not the actual thing that I use. All right. I've talked about my kids on the show and my wife, and you know their names. So instead of putting, you know, Lisa, Lucas, Skyler, you know, and then a number, let's say our wedding anniversary, you know, whatever, Lisa, Lucas, Skyler, 24. Instead, I would put wife, son, daughter, anniversary in the password app. And now, of course, that's not difficult information to find out about me. This is just an example. But there are things that I know that you don't know the reference at all. Like, it would be impossible for you to know the reference, but it's enough to remind me. And then I can reverse it. I could do son, daughter, wife, and, you know, a birthday or something. You know, again, these are not the things that I'm using. And I could choose to do son with a capital S or son with a lowercase s. And now I know to type his name with the capital L or the lowercase L or initials or any of those things. So it is a thing that tells me and only me what the password is. And anybody else seeing that would be like, I got nothing for you. I have no idea what this reference is. And so that's another way of doing it. Don't use your spouse or your kids' names, because that's stuff that's easily discoverable about you. But yeah, things that might not be discoverable about you would be the way to do that. So,
well, so the way I'm reading it, though, is he doesn't even put it in there. So there's no way for them to find it. So he just pushed an asterisk there to remind himself, hey, put your own code in.
Right. But if the password is breached, I guess this would work in both cases. If the password on the server, not the password in 1Password.
Oh, right.
If the password's on the server is breached and he's using the same PIN in every case, now that's the weak point. But that would be the same for mine, right? If you didn't know my kids' names or my wife's name, and you know, I wasn't someone who went on a podcast every week and said them routinely.
To the world.
to the world. Yeah, exactly. Then, you know, if you saw that, you'd be like, ah, wait, I understand his formula. Okay, now I can hack everything that he's done. So, and that would be true about me, too.
Boy, that would be hard to do. Assuming, right, that the password is all hashed and How are you going to get the password? Right. Well, oh, okay. You're laughing at me. All right. Oh, okay. Fair enough. I have just.
This is why we don't use the same password everywhere, man.
This is why I've been schooled. Well, fair
passwords
enough.
Passwords are, but they're not always stored hashed. That's the thing we found. Yeah.
Yeah. It depends on the sites you go to and stuff like that. And here's the, to Dave's point, who do you think is more likely to have less secure password, like policies or how they're storing things, or is that more likely that the reputable password manager is going to have that issue? Or is it more likely that like your well, think of all the people that use a like local bank, like, or around here, like since moving here, a lot of the services that I log into, like even the hospital that I go to, their site sucks. And I can guarantee you that the IT people that put together the password stuff there, not to disparage them, maybe they're really, really great, but it's much more likely that they're making a mistake or not as secure as 1Password.
Right.
Just saying.
For like, absolute certain.
I've seen the front end of their website and I can see like how the forms are set up. Like, yeah, I'm not, they're probably not doing, you know, weapons grade military like
no
policies. Maybe they are. Yeah. Like again, I'm not trying to throw shade on anybody.
No, but I
there's
there
a
is,
lot of indicators like that this is probably not as secure.
Fair
as
enough.
That.
Yeah. I need to be very careful about how much I speak here. My family's probably, if they're listening, they're probably going, oh no, Dave, don't talk about this. But as someone who has built databases in my life and is someone who has built them quickly and it with the interest of getting them launched, I am very aware of the kinds of things that are overlooked in that process. And there have been more than a few times in my life where I've taken a look at something that's been stood up very quickly, often by a very reputable, perhaps even government agency, whatever. And it's like, yeah, I guarantee you there's a hole here. And there's always a hole. It's eventually plugged, but eventually can take a very long time. And so, yeah, to Adam's point, you know, something, especially like you said, your local little, maybe your banks are different because there are regulations and there's like people that come and make sure your
just
policies
like healthcare
are there.
Regulations.
It's fair.
You hope.
Right. Yeah. No, but like, you're right. Yeah. But things get overlooked. And even when on the surface, they pass all of the, okay, you're doing all the right things. You're checking all the right boxes. Yep. Look two layers deep. And it's like you said, why is this all being stored in the clear in a text file? Well, yeah we're going to get to that. Like we had to get it up and running. We had to get it up and running is the bane of security's existence.
Convenience versus security.
That's it. Yeah. And convenience isn't just about you / us, the users. It's about the people putting it together. They are making similar decisions about security versus their convenience, aka speed in getting something launched.
So
I have an ad hoc quick tip then. It doesn't help with the healthcare side, but go freeze your credit accounts at the credit bureaus. It's free. It used to cost money to do, but no one, even if they have your name, your password, your social security number and all that stuff, in theory, if the financial institution is doing the right thing, no one can open credit in your name if your credit bureau accounts are frozen.
There's three of them, right? I want to make sure because I'll put links.
TransUnion.
Correct.
And
Experian.
Yep.
Yeah. I will find links because I have them before this episode is published. Yeah. I will put links in the show notes to where you can go to freeze those. And if you want those links automatically delivered to your inbox so you don't have to remember to go and look at the website. Like, oh, I got to go back and look at the website. Don't worry about it. Go to MacGeekGab.com one time, put in your email address. Once a week, we will send you an email that has all the links that are in the episode, and you've just got them. You can archive the email. You can do whatever you want. Of course, we archive it too. You know, it's on the site, MacGeekGab.com. But this way, you've got them. You can just go through and you can click. You can learn about all the things we talk about. And we promise we don't sell your name to people. Obviously. I mean, I know we need to say it, but obviously. Yeah. If we were going to sell your name would have to be worth a lot, lot. I mean, everybody's got a price. I don't know what ours is, but it's really high because we kind of need to sleep at night and we're not the kind of people.
It's more than $50.
It's way more than $50. Yeah, it's way more than other people value your name. Your privacy far higher than other people value access to you. So, yeah, it's not a thing.
And have your password manager up when you do go freeze your credit report, because they're going to give you pins that you need to unfreeze it, or even you can't open credit in your name.
Well, I mean, not the case. Usually, because I just had to do it. You just create an account there, which you would store in your password manager.
Right. That's what I mean. You need to be able to recall how to get into your own account there.
Yes.
But usually, and then it's easy. Like when you go get a car, you go, okay, well, which one of these three do you use? And you only need to unfreeze the one that they use when they want to run a credit check.
As long as they know which one they're using, which sometimes some don't. They don't. Yeah. Yep. So, all right. We've done 3/4 of an episode full of, I guess, backup and quick tips and other discussions. Shall we? Let's jump to some show business here. I want to address a couple of reviews, and in that I want to share them because they're fantastic, and reviews help the show quite a bit. So go to mattgeekup.com/review, and then that's where you can go and review the show, and that really helps us. I'm looking for these reviews as I'm talking here, and I can't find them to save my life. Oh, I found it. Great. Oh, I didn't move them over. Our first review comes from Simon Locke, who says, 5 stars, owning anything Apple, this show is a must. Updated March 2025 review. I keep updating this review because this show really deserves a place in your podcast player. I've been a dedicated listener for more than 15 years, and it remains my absolute favorite podcast about Apple products. Whether you are a beginner or an expert, this show has something for everyone. The hosts do an incredible job of breaking down complex topics in a way that is easy to understand while still keeping it engaging for more advanced users. The production quality is always top-notch with clear audio and a professional yet friendly atmosphere. It's truly my go-to podcast whenever I want to learn something new or just enjoy a great discussion about Apple products and tech. If you're into Apple, this podcast is an absolute must. Thank you, Simon Locke. That means a lot. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Yeah, great stuff.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, amazing. And then we have one more from RN Doug. And, I got to type it in the right way because I'm sure I didn't put this one in the right place. RN Doug, 5 stars, the best Apple-related podcast out there. I've been a listener for a number of years, and this remains my favorite podcast. The crew gives great tips and content without the pontification you see in other casts. Listen, you and I pontificated a little bit at the end of last week's episode, but you know.
Did we?
Well, about AI and, right, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we did.
Listening feels more like hanging out talking tech with friends than listening to content. MGG also has the best Discord server out there. You know what? That's my review of this show. I agree with RN Doug. We have the best Discord server out there. It is like the one place on the internet where everybody... It's not just civil discussion. It's productive, friendly, full of camaraderie. It's a big family of 2,000 people, 2,500 people, whatever it is now. It's freaking amazing. And that y'all rock. Thank you for that. That's utterly amazing. So, yeah. So those are the reviews that we have. And then, we did talk about figuring out how to share the load on thanking our premium listeners, but we didn't do anything about that. So I'm just going to be the one to thank those of you whose contributions came in the last week. So thanking the following for their $25 contributions that came in the last week here. Doug from Richmond, Wayne from Waipahu, Randy from Westport, Anthony from Bournemouth, Stephen from Linlithgow, Sharon from Wesley Chapel, Fernando from somewhere, Michael from Omaha, Robbie from Hendersonville, Andrew from Honolulu, Bryn from Sun City, Ed from Torrance, Roger from Hove, Curate from Bloomfield Hills, and Mark from New Palestine. Thank you for your $25 contributions and $10 contributions. Thanks to Stephen in Plainfield, John in Vienna, Joseph in Marietta, Barry in Des Plaines, Kevin in Brandon, Jonathan in Plainsboro, Paul in Lawrenceville, James in Amity Harbor, and John in Wake Forest. You all rock. Thank you, thank you. Thank you, thank you. So outstanding. Is it time to move on to questions?
Yep.
All right.
Don't get caught.
What's that? No.
We're questions, or don't get caught?
We're moving to questions. David says, I got to find David's question for you. David's question is very simple. It's a short one. He says, I get an error. Failed to eject. Credence 11M6270. Yada, yada, yada. Secure PKI trust store assets. Yada, yada, yada. Because it is currently in use. What the heck does this mean, Adam?
The Swiss very thing. And part of it is cryptics. So credence is at the front. The last word is cryptics. So it's like, what the heck is credence? Cryptics. What is going on here? And I did not know anything about this. But basically, this is something that apparently started showing up for some users in macOS 10, 15X Sequoia. So it seems to have started maybe around 0.1 or 0.2. It wasn't really clear from the research I did online. But what these are parts of the file system disk images that normally you should never ever see. They're related to some of the security features that Apple has been adding. They're specifically there to store encrypted data, key storage for authentication, to ensure security of sensitive data like passwords, encryption keys, certificates. So they're like a portion of your drive that Apple has set aside for all this like security stuff. Really? Normally, they're not supposed to be visible to the users, but something in some users' systems when they upgraded to Sequoia started causing them to appear. Now, it's not really clear if it's like a bug on Apple's side or it's related to third-party tools or software that were installed in the past. I'm going to guess it's related to, you know how we used to have those things that would let you like access parts of the file system? I can't remember. There was one of them related to like S3 stuff and network storage things and stuff like that. But there used to be third-party tools you could add to that would like make things visible in your file system. Or maybe you did the thing where you could see Windows formatted drives and read and write to them. I think there were some tools for that, these sorts of things.
Yeah.
So they kind of like add on, bolt on like extensions or things into the file system that let it do more than it's. So I don't know if it's related to that or what. It's not really clear, but apparently some users are seeing these things. And so that's what it is. You're not supposed to see them mounted, so you can't normally eject them. So that's like what this message is like, it's trying to eject that and it can't because it's not allowed to and yada, yada, yada. Right. So if this is happening to you, apparently there's some things that you can check. One would be check if you do have apps or utilities set up to run at login. So, you know, go into your login items and see if there's something in there. So under system settings, general login items, see if there's anything in there, a utility or a tool or something that might be related to your drives or storage or that sort of thing. You could also check for security extensions. So there's extensions specifically related to security, and I didn't know that these were there, but if you go into system settings, privacy and security extensions, and then there's a thing called added extensions, you could see if there's anything in there maybe related to that. So if you're seeing these things, apparently you can see them not only in the Finder but also in disk utility if you're having this problem. If you don't see them, nothing to worry about. You should never ever see them, so you're fine. But you can also boot into safe mode and see if those volumes go away. Because if they do, that's a good indication that it's some sort of third-party software that is likely the issue. Because when you boot into safe mode, right, none of that third-party stuff will load. So if you don't see Credence Cryptic's volumes after being in safe mode, then you know you can start the hunt for what third-party thing do I have on here. And so to boot into safe mode on an Apple Silicon Mac, you shut down the Mac, you press and hold the power button on your Mac until the loading startup options appear. You select your boot volume, and then you press and hold the shift key, and then click continue to go into safe mode. I think on Intel Macs, it's literally just reboot with the shift key on, and it'll go into, I don't know why it got, I think it got more complicated on Silicon Macs because of the, again, because of the encryption security stuff.
Yeah, but yeah.
Anyway, on Intel Mac, you can just hold down the shift key and boot. And then finally, make sure you're on the latest version of macOS. So if it is a bug, you know, hopefully newer versions of macOS 15 have resolved that. So
interesting. Huh. Credence Cryptic. Rolls off the tongue Credence in a fun Cryptic. Little way.
Yeah. I don't know why it's called that, or I couldn't find a lot of information about it, probably because it's security related and Apple probably doesn't want to publish a lot of information about it. So
yeah. Interesting. Huh? Man. What is? Interesting. Love it. Okay. Yeah, I have nothing to add. Shall we move on?
We shall.
Okay. I think you're reading the next one, Adam.
From Joe?
Yep, I was just trying to get it pulled up here.
Got
sorry.
It. All right, no problem.
Because I had to read the Credence Cryptic stuff because
yes.
I couldn't remember.
Yeah,
all
yeah,
that.
Yeah. We didn't pace this the right way now that I'm thinking about it. It's all good.
Joe says, how do I stop Windows from enlarging when I drag them in macOS 15? Is there a way to turn off the capability in the new version of macOS? It is really irritating and additional work to have to make windows that have enlarged on my laptop screen when I attempt to move them. So yeah, this is like some new feature. I didn't know this existed until right when we were doing the show. If you like drag it close to an edge or something like that, it just like auto resizes.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And it is annoying. There is a way, at least that I found, to disable it. If you go into system settings and then go to the desktop and dock pane, there is a Windows section there. And there are some options you can disable. And one of those options is drag Windows to screen edge to tile. And then also drag Windows to menu bar to fill screen. Turn those off. And hopefully your Mac will stop doing that. So you don't even have to, find some defaults right command. It's there in system settings. And then there's others that you might want to leave on. The one that I've left on is hold option while dragging to tile a window, which is kind of the way I would like it to be. Instead of, dragging it to the edge, if I want it, I'll hold down the option key and then we're all on the same page. So that's the answer. I think. So, yep. Sweet.
Yeah.
Pete, are you reading the next one? Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. Sweet. So he writes in, I don't know who wrote in, but he wrote in and he said, hi, Dave, Adam, and Pilot Pete. I have an extensive collection. I'm stilping here. I have an extensive collection of CDs and DVDs with some Blu-ray and would like to digitize it all. However, one, is the quality I would get by repurchasing each item I already have on physical media better than that what I would get if I ripped any of the aforementioned? I realized that even at the highest quality, ripping a CD is still dependent on what the master quality is that they used when they created the CD or DVD in the first place. I also realized that it takes time to convert and then store, etc. But if the quality is better, I may opt to just repurchase. Now, the final question, can you recommend an optical drive, which is fast, reliable, and USB-C? Thanks for all you do. So I'd want to get rid of degrading optical media.
Hmm. Yep. And I'm sorry, I threw this one in there. This was Sensano, I think it's.
Okay.
Sensano?
Sure.
So that's who this is from. So my answer was basically yes, in my opinion, any new digital version of something that you would buy from a service online, I buy almost exclusively from Apple. you know, is going to be a 4K version or better. And that's going to be generally or definitely better quality than anything you could rip from a DVD. Blu-ray, you're going to get a little better. But Apple's digital versions are excellent quality, in my opinion, at least in my experience. So, you know, that's generally the route that I go. But obviously, that has the downside of the fact that it locks you into whatever platform you're purchasing from, right? And you're not going to be able to share, trade, resell, transfer, any of that stuff like you could if you actually had the physical media. So that's for sure a downside to, you know, kind of not doing it on your own.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of make that choice, right? And then as far as like actually, you know, what to get if you do want to like rip your own, I would say just about any name brand USB-C optical drive that you can find on Amazon that is Mac OS compatible should be fine. At least in my experience, I had one from LG that worked great. It was, you know, USB bus powered. It was really thin. It did Blu-ray, DVD, CD. I mean, that technology's been around for so long. I haven't really run into any issues. The key is make sure you find one that's Mac compatible because they're not all Mac compatible.
Most of them are now, but but you're right. Like, yeah.
Remember how expensive those things used to be? Hundreds of dollars.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
They're still not cheap, in my opinion. You're still going to spend around $100, I would think, on a quality one, which is not terrible, but I mean, the technology's so old, like who really uses it anymore? But that's exactly what happened is they don't sell as many, so the price is going to be a little
bit
so
old. They don't even bother to put it in the machines from Apple anymore.
Well, again, you can purchase or acquire a lot of high quality copies online.
That's fair. One thing I will point out about Apple's is that they are still compressed. And especially the sound, Apple TV does not support uncompressed, you know, Atmos sound or anything. So all the stuff that you get now, whether your system and or your ears are able to discern a meaningful difference between compressed via Apple, which is compressed fairly well and not overly compressed or anything, whether you can tell the difference. That's up to you. But if you're going to rip a Blu-ray using something like Make MKV, then you can get the, you know, the raw thing. It's going to be massive. You know, it's going to be, you know, 60 gigs or something for a movie. But you can do it. And then you can have the completely DRM-free, you know, super portable, well, portable from an encryption security standpoint, maybe portable depending on how much storage you have, you know, because these things are huge. But that would be the way to do it. And Make MKV is the app, as far as I know. I haven't found anything else. Although it's been a little while since I've ripped a DVD, but that's the one that I always go to. If you know of a better way, feedback@macgeekgab.com, please.
That's a great idea. Feedback@macgeekgab.com. Tell us.
Yeah, that's what I would do. Feedback@macgab.com.
Let's
now, Dave, wait. Yeah. Before we move on, I have a question about the audio thing with Apple TV. So is Atmos not a good substitute?
Well, Atmos is amazing.
Well, most of their stuff's in Atmos, right? And Apple TV's latest Apple TVs will do Atmos.
Correct. Right? But they won't do uncompressed Atmos. So what Atmos is, so Atmos is not a format. It is a standardized way of adding metadata to the audio stream to describe where any given sound should appear audibly to come from. It the old way of doing things is to say, all right, you know, you've got, let's say, 5.1 sound, right? You know, and so that's left, right, left, center, right, rear, left, and right, and then the 0.1 is your subwoofer. And you would say, all right, make this sound come out of the left speaker, make this sound come out of the center speaker, make this come out of the subwoofer. And you could be discreet about that, you know, as the engineer mixing it. With Atmos, you don't mix for a specific system. You mix for the room, and it's up to the system to interpret the metadata that says, okay, this sound should appear to, or it sound like it's coming above you, or sound like it's coming from behind you. And then the system takes that and, based on what its capabilities are, interprets it in that particular environment. So everybody, regardless of what your system is, you get whatever version of that experience you can recreate. And so Atmos is awesome, and it can be a lot of fun. But the underlying audio signal is the thing that matters here. And it often is a 7.1 signal that then is adapted if the receiver or the processor can do Atmos. If it can't, then you just get 7.1 and it's mixed for that and you're fine. But uncompressed sound has more data than compressed sound. And again, Apple compresses it pretty well. But if, like, for example, if you have uncompressed Atmos, like, you know, Plex can't play that on an Apple TV, because the Apple TV has no way to pass that through. Even though the device on the other end is like, yeah, give me the uncompressed thing. The Apple TV is like, no, we can only pass through compressed data. It's like, there's no reason for this. It's a software limitation. But that's, so yes, I know that got way geekier than you probably
intended. No, that's what I wanted to know. Okay. Because obviously, you know, I was unaware of that. So
yep.
I think other people might be unaware of also that. So unaware, I appreciate the explanation.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, it's, I love this stuff. Okay. I think, Pete, you had a really cool stuff found, and I want to make sure we don't miss this. So let's jump to cool stuff found and wrap up the show there.
Oh, okay. Well, I, for those that are on the Discord, I put some pictures in there that I recently got, because I got this thing at CES. I saw it at CES, and it's called Feather Snap. As feathers in on a bird, and snap as in snapshots. This thing is a bird feeder with two sides to it. So you can put in two different types of bird feed to attract a wider variety of birds. And oh, by the way, they've got a hummingbird feeder coming out later this year. But it does motion sensitivity and takes high definition photos. And you can request a video of it as well. And you can then slow-mo the video and that sort of thing. But I've got a house finch, a cardinal, a blue jay, some amazing birds already right up close, and watch them eating and watch them, you know, shell the seeds. And if you're into birds at all, this is really cool. And I'm not even that much into birds, but I just find this absolutely fascinating. And the pictures are amazing. And here's the cool thing. If you get a bird and you don't know what it is, it has links to AI right in the app on your phone to help you determine what kind of bird it is that you're seeing. So if you're at all into it. Yeah. And right now you can get it. We have a link in the show notes for Amazon. It's $169 instead of its regular $189. And like I say, the hummingbird feeder is due out soon. Which I totally have every intent of getting one of those as well, because I love to watch hummingbirds. And I imagine those.
One's solar powered. Is that right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I missed that. Yeah, it's solar powered, so you never have to recharge the camera. It recharges itself on a daily basis.
So cool.
Yeah.
Huh.
And
I love it. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I actually put in a ticket for them, because I was having a hard time getting it to join my network. And I put in a ticket when I figured out what it was doing. It was me. I was forcing everything to go. We talked about it the other day, the different DNS. I was forcing everything to go to a different DNS, and it wanted to go to its own DNS and was fighting me on that. And once I let it go, it got its own DNS and came right up and worked. But these are beautiful pictures.
They just really are.
Huh. Yeah. I've got one in the cardinal in there is just amazing. And he keeps coming back. So I've got some amazing video of him. So
yeah, I might have to get the hummingbird feeder one. I love taking pictures of our hummingbirds. Yeah.
Huh. Right.
All right.
Yeah. So yeah, Feather Snap, is That was a fun one. I'm really excited to get one of those feeders.
Cool.
Yeah.
You've got the next one, right, Adam?
Oh, we're doing
cool stuff found. Hold on. It's okay. We're doing Rob.
I didn't know we were going forward. I thought we were wrapping up.
Oh.
But we got a little bit of time.
We got a little bit of time. Yeah.
So this is from Rob. And Rob has a little AI tool for doing terminal. So he said, I stumbled on this and I knew you all would be interested. Well, we are. This is a new command line utility powered by AI. It's called warp.dev. I'm just scratching the surface of it, but it seems amazing. It will help you with syntax, context, and help you with scripting, etc. So it's at warp.dev. We'll have the link in the show notes. But yeah, it looks like it allows you to, you can basically just tell it like what you're wanting to do in the terminal, and it will interpret that and then help give you the commands. So you don't have to remember things like, you know, how do I grab the name of a directory and copy it to my clipboard? That sort of thing.
Oh, man. I mean, this makes sense. I do this kind of thing with ChatGPT, open in one window and my terminal in another, copy pasting back and forth. For me, it's like, all right, I want to convert the show. I need to use FFmpeg. How do I use FFmpeg to do this? And it's this back and forth kind of copy paste thing. This takes this out of the equation. Of course, somebody created this. Oh, so man.
Now you can just ask your terminal.
Yeah.
I didn't look up what it works with. I'm assuming it's going through something like a chat, the different engines, as most of these tools do.
Yeah.
I would assume like ChatGPT or something like that. But
yeah, it doesn't. You're right. It's not obvious. Privacy probably tells you what it's using, maybe. LLMs, telemetry, settings, privacy, how Warp works. Warp AI. Are powered by large language models running in the background. Maybe it's their own. I didn't realize.
Maybe it's their own.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. There is a privacy link there. I don't want to spend the time here trying to parse it, but yeah, it is there to get you that information. Wow. That's pretty cool. Huh. Thanks, Rob. Good stuff.
Yeah.
I have one from Tony that, Tony says, while listening to another popular Mac podcast, you can tell us which one. We like to promote other shows. one of the co-hosts griped about the difficulty in identifying the active window on their Mac desktop. Confused for a second until I remembered a great little utility I found a long, long time ago and have been using ever since. It's an app called Haze Over, and it dims inactive windows and makes the active window the brightest one. So now I never have trouble knowing which window is active. It's $6 and it's in setup. But yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. I need to mess with this and see if I like it. Like I don't know how much I wind up looking at inactive windows and reading things from them, you know, without making them active. I can totally see the benefit to this with current workflows, or with some workflows, rather. Yeah. And you can set the degree of hazing over, too, which is handy. Huh. Yeah. Hazeover.com, or if you have a setup subscription that's in setup. I love it.
Confused with Hazel.com.
Right. Hazeover, yeah. Hazel. Yep, there's a song in there somewhere. I don't know.
Yeah.
Something. Yep. I have one more cool stuff found that I'll throw in, and it's, you know, I test headphones. I test a lot of headphones, and it's difficult for me to like come up with the reason to recommend something. The folks at One More have lots of different headphones, and I just tested their, I'll call them their high end. They're called the Sonoflow, and it's One More, the number one M-O-R-E, Sonoflow Pro noise canceling headphones. These are over the ear headphones. They've got high res Bluetooth audio, Bluetooth 5.4, 100 hours of play time, great noise canceling, really comfortable fit. They come in a nice case that packs down fairly flat to fit in your travel bag. I use them going back and forth to South by Southwest. They sound great. The noise canceling works fantastic on the flight, and they're $70. That's the thing. They're $70. So it's like, okay, wait a minute. And you can wire them if you want to, like if you wanted to plug into, you know, the airplane thing or get completely lossless audio, you know, obviously the hard wire is the way to go. So yeah, $70 on Amazon right now. So that, to me, that was the differentiator. It's like, wait a minute, I have $300 headphones that these sound kind of the same. And so, yep. It's got a 40mm driver in each ear. Like they sound good. If I have one complaint, and I have this complaint about several headphones, is that when in noise canceling mode, sometimes the sound isn't loud enough. And I really don't like to listen loud. I'm fairly tuned into where my hearing, you know, needs to be, and I'm not, you know, pushing 85 dB plus to my ears. But yeah, they were a little quiet, but I find that with a lot of over the ear headphones with noise canceling, it's certainly not limited to them. But everything was intelligible. I guess maybe the right way to say it is I was listening with them cranked. And then everything was fine, but it was, you know, there wasn't any headroom, but I could still hear everything. And I swear I'm really not terribly deaf. So, but yeah, no, really, for $70, man, I happily used them on both flights back and forth to South By, and I'll use them this week back and forth to Chicago for Podcast Movement. So, yep. Good stuff. Damn. We have anything else to add? I guess that's it.
Not here.
I got nothing.
I guess it's time. The band. There they are. Amazing.
They're there. How did they know? Right on time.
I know. Well, I think they're just playing the whole time. And when I bring up the fader, there they are. They're just like magic. Yeah, it's great. Love it. They're, they're professionals. On Gig Gab, our catchphrase over there is always be performing. I think the band here... I think they
heard you.
They took it to heart. Yeah, they're always performing. So you could just like take it out and talk for a little bit, and then you just bring up the fader, and there they are, back to
24/7, 365.
365. That's it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Don't their fingers ever get tired?
I would imagine. It turns out I'm the drummer on that track, and so yeah, sometimes my fingers get tired. I guess so. Yeah. It's a whole like. Parallel universe, multiverse kind of thing going on, I think is what's happening. Thanks for hanging out with us, everybody. Thanks to BZG Apps for doing our giveaway. There's one day left of our March giveaway, and yes, there is an April giveaway coming, which you will be able to check out on April 1st. That is not a joke. But yeah, Unite 6, they're giving away 5 copies of that with us this month, so if you're listening to this on or somehow before March 31st, make sure to sign up for that. Thanks to Cashfly for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. Check out Pete's other show, So There I Was, Adam's other show, the debut film podcast, and my other shows, Business Brain and Gig Gab, as I mentioned. We can't stop talking, I guess. So, yep. Go leave a review. MattGeekGab.com/review. We'd love it. Really, it helps the whole thing. So
5 stars.
5 stars.
5 stars.
5 stars. Pete's right. Pete's very right. Thanks, everybody. Thanks to all our premium listeners. Thanks to everybody who's listening. Thanks to everybody who sends in questions. Thanks to you. What are you, it's nice to have you back, Pete. I missed you last
week. Nice to be back.
What, you got anything to add before we say goodbye?
I do. It 3 simple words. I bet you know what they are, but I'm going to tell you anyway. Don't get caught.
Made on Mac.
I knew what they were, Pete. Later.